If you look on the web or read the literature, you find that many people, quite a few in the Agile community, but even in the software world at large, there are people who have had bad experiences with software architects, to the point where they feel we don't need any software architects. So you might say we have an architect crisis. I looked around on the web, on various websites and blogs, and I came up with a sampling of quotes I think you might find interesting to illustrate the point. Everyone should be an architect. It should not be the responsibility of one person. Naming someone as an architect makes architecture something that only the architect has to worry about. That means all the team, rest of the team has to do is code and not think about design. We now have a first among equals. I'm sure everyone has suffered through that one. Everybody, they say, will defer to the almighty architect. And then we'll follow that one opinion full speed ahead to disaster. We're better off coaching the team and training everyone to be an architect. And my favorite one, architects talk in bubbles. Developers talk in code. When software architects hear this, they conjure up in their minds this picture. Anybody recognize this house? I'll give you a little hint. It's in San Jose, California. That's right, it's the Winchester Mystery House. Sarah Winchester, who was the heir to the Winchester rifle fortune, built it. She had a lot of money, because in those days, just like everyone today has an iPod, everyone then had a Winchester rifle. She had a $20 million inheritance, and that doesn't sound like a lot of money, but that was $1,880, which is about $440 million today. Now, with that amount of money, she wouldn't be on the Forbes 400 list. But remember, there was no income tax until 1913 in the United States. At any rate, carpenters worked 24 hours a day for 38 years building this house. There were 160 rooms. Windows were built into the floor. Staircases led to nowhere. A chimney that raises, you know, four floors, doors that open onto blank walls, upside-down posts. She lived in the house. The serving staff needed a map to navigate around the house. She didn't do this because she did not like architects, although we don't really know. She was driven by the fear of the ghosts of her husband and child, who both died prematurely. So this house represents the fear that people have when they say they won't have any architects. There'll be no architecture. We'll have the software equivalent of the Winchester Mystery House. But this is not really what people are saying, because in reality, nobody condemns architecture. James Copeland put it very well in his introduction to Bob Martin's Lean Code. The late 1990s notions of design driven only by the tests and the code are long gone. The idea that no design is needed has been banished to the dustbin of software history. Because if you design a test, think about it, you need some class in mind to test. And that class has to come from some mental model, which means there was some design done, even if not explicitly. No, what people dispute is whether you need a software architect to get architecture. How many people recognize this painting? Not too many of you, I didn't think so. You might say this is the classic painting of classic art. It was done by a French painter by the name of Ing, although his name is spelled I-N-G-R-E-S, like the database. This picture is called Apotheosis of Homer. And you can see it is a brilliant, impressive painting with impressive craftsmanship. This painting tells the story of Homer as the central figure of classical knowledge. You see surrounding him are all the great figures of the humanities, even those that came after him. Plato, Mozart, Voltaire, Orpheus, among others, are in the painting. You see very sharp, distinct colors. You see Homer in the center of a hierarchical grouping as he's being crowned by an angel. But what's wrong with this painting? Well, the Impressionists and others thought it was false. Why? Because the picture doesn't come from life. It's a mythological, artificial story. It's artificially arranged, and it's not reflective of real life. Colors in real life, under light, do not look this bright. You don't get the blues or the reds or the greens that are that sharp. Allegorically, this is somehow what some agilists see what software architects do. They produce a grandiose, very contrived scheme divorced from reality. And so the Impressionists came and said, let's paint for real life. So of all the paintings and controversies that follow over the next few decades, I picked one to show you a different approach. Now, who recognizes this painting? It's, of course, Van Gogh's Starry Night. And even though this painting does not look to you as an exact replica of the Starry Night, it certainly gives you the same experience of awe that you might feel if you saw a Starry Night. And the colors themselves are much closer to what you might actually see in a dark night illuminated only by stars. So what conclusions do I draw from these two paintings? Architecture and painting share a common problem. And what problem is that? How do you get the right abstraction? Because a painting is a two-dimensional abstraction of a three-dimensional world. To achieve the illusion of three dimensions, painters use techniques such as foreshortening or alter how the colors appear, among other techniques. And the Impressionists and others viewed these techniques as the wrong abstractions to use, such as the post-Impressionist Van Gogh did in order to get the true experience of a starry night. So what does it mean to have fidelity to the real world? What do you abstract away to produce what you really see? And so for architecture has the same problem, because it's all about extracting from the real world those features that we need to build a model for our application. So it's exactly the same problem a painter has, how to get the right abstraction. So now let's look at two more paintings and push this metaphor a little further before we get back to talking directly about architects and architectures. This is another very famous painting. It's Picasso, Violin and Grapes. So what did Picasso do here? If the painting is all about getting the right abstraction, we can play around with how we represent the fundamental shapes of reality. He took those fundamental shapes of the world and rearranged them to create a sense of the basic shapes of reality forming together an object. You can reassemble the violin in your mind, and Picasso probably wanted us to do that. But he also wanted us to get a sense that this was an act of reconstruction on our part. And of course, if we had more time, we'd go into more detail about this painting. The next painting is a Kandinsky, and he abstracted the world in a very different way than Picasso. He wanted painting to create within the viewer the same feeling that a work of music might provide. Emotions not hindered by an experience of being mediated by some real-world artifact. So the question then becomes, how much of the real world do we want to show in painting or architecture? So it's not just a question of abstraction, but what is the relationship between abstraction and the real world? And you can see the same tension in painting that we have in architecture. We have a world that we have to imperfectly represent in our software. And as you can see from the Picasso, the Kandinsky, a little bit in the Van Gogh, the more abstract, the further you get from the real world. And finally, you can take this so far, and this is the last painting we'll look at. Here is Jackson Pollock's number 6. The spontaneity of the experience and the freshness of the inspiration is what's important. So here you are totally removed from reality. So the question then becomes, and this to me is the fundamental question, what is the fundamental role of the painter? What is the fundamental role of the software architect? So you can see in the Eng, the Van Gogh, the Picasso, the Kandinsky, the Pollock, It's not the craftsmanship they wanted you to admire, although all these painters, including Pollock, were master craftsmen. It was the viewing experience. Rubens had a whole team of painters. Some were experts in faces. Some were experts in painting the sky. Some did hands, but they were not called John Doe or Jane Schmidt paintings. They were called Rubens because he was the one responsible for the experience of the painting. The painter creates the viewing experience through the appropriate abstraction. The architect is responsible for the user experience through the appropriate abstractions. And now I'll explain in a minute exactly what I mean by user experience. But the architect is responsible for keeping the program's unity such that it is usable by a person or a group of people. And that is not as easy as you think it is. Architecture is not about software design or craftsmanship. For those of you who think the job of the architect is to be the reviewer of all code, or the master designer, or the reviewer of all design decisions are wrong. In this, the Agilists are absolutely right. Being a good architect is not about being an uber programmer. Going from developer to architect requires a mind shift. Architect is not the next job step after developer. Both are necessary jobs. But now let's use this metaphor of user experience to explore this in a little more detail. How many people have read The Mythical Man Month? Great book. Must be over 30 years old by now. Fantastic book. Everybody should read it. One of the major ideas in the book, in fact, you might say it is the critical idea in the book, is that the ease of use of software is dictated by the unity of design, or what Brooks calls conceptual integrity. To Brooks, conceptual integrity was the critical factor in building software. And Brooks built some real software. The OS 360 was a complicated piece of software and hardware. Conceptual integrity is what makes a work of art or piece of software hang together. Without this integrity, the users are going to have a bad experience. And this experience transcends the user interface. User interface is only a part of the user experience. Let's go back and remember what those paintings were like. What created the experience? Think of Van Gogh's Starry Night. Was it this line or that line or some other line or color that created the experience? No, it was the entire painting as a whole that created the experience. The experience is an emergent property of the painting. Similarly, with software, some of the most important experiences for the user are emergent. Performance. You can't isolate a particular part of the application and say you get the performance here and solve the problem. I learned this many, many years ago when I did CAD-CAM software. With electrical CAD, you could write a state function and describe the inputs and outputs of the system. When I moved to doing mechanical CAD, you couldn't do this. To reduce the weight of a mechanical device required to work with the property of the entire system. And the same thing is true of scalability or security or ease of deployment or workflow. They're not isolated to a particular section of code or functionality. You can't write a use case that says this application should scale. Of course, you can write a non-functional requirement that says the application should scale, but who do you assign it to? Suppose somebody writes some code that satisfies a particular user story but breaks the security of the system. Every single developer is going to have to pay attention to every non-functional requirement. And sometimes you have to change the implementation of several use cases to get the scalability you need. Who's responsible for making sure that this gets done? The architect. I don't know what your experience is like, but in my experience, unless one person's responsible for this, it doesn't happen. Just like when you sign up to do a particular use case or user story, you are responsible for it. The architect is responsible for the user experience. The fact of the matter is, not everything fits in a use case or a user story. And not everything lives in code. What about the famous dictum? The code is the design. The code is the artifact. The code is everything. Well, if you have to do replication, there's a big difference in reliability and performance between mirroring and transaction log shipping. Where is that in code? You might have to code differently if you make a different choice. to do one of these things. Where are the load balancers? How do you handle state? Makes a big difference depending on how you handle load balancing. What about virtualized service? That doesn't show up in the code. Somebody has to be responsible for what does not show up in code. The buck stops with the architect. And culture matters. Sometimes I think we developers and architects live in Lake Wobegon, where everyone is above average. The fact of the matter is that we all live with the bell curve. Just because five bright people use a methodology and get great results, maybe it was because they were great developers and they would have succeeded no matter what methodology they picked. Look at this graph from Boehm and Turner's Balancing Agility and Discipline, which talks about how plan-driven or agile your software project should be. You have to look at your development environment and how experienced your developers are and how critical the application is and what the size in terms of personalities are and what the skill of your personnel and the dynamic nature of the requirements change. For example, some developers do not want to take the initiative. They want to be told what to do, and that is their psychological reality. Picking a methodology that requires independent thinking from everyone is not going to be successful. If your workplace is composed of people like that, you have to work with the developers you have, not the developers you want. How mission-critical your app is going to be matters. There's a big difference with how much upfront design you need if you are building a bowling application or you're building the software for a medical application. You have to understand the culture, the people you have, and the dynamic nature of the product you are building. Applications are not built in a vacuum. You have to consider these factors, and they're just as important as getting a use case done. I like to think of architecture as a narrative. People talk about having a good metaphor for a system, but to me, a good system tells a story. And the story starts with the business people. This is not a particularly revolutionary idea, but one of the jobs of the architect is to mediate between the business people and the technologists. And what do I mean by this? Not everybody can understand the business. It's unreasonable to think that people who have expertise in software can also be experts in the domain. And there are areas like telecommunications or finance that can take years and years to master. So we have domain experts. And it's not realistic to expect every developer to understand everything about a particular business. And certainly, on the other hand, technology has gotten very complicated, and it's unreasonable to expect the business people or the domain experts to understand all the technological implications of what they want to do. I've seen this so many times. I try to explain to my clients that just because you can express an idea simply, you can implement it simply. English hides a great deal of ambiguity, and that's a good thing, because life would not be very pleasant if you had to be blunt with everybody in the same way you have to be with a computer. The world would not be a very nice place to live. How often does a business owner say, "I want this, just do it," and then you start to ask, "What about this and what about that?" And a while later, the better clients understand that what they wanted was not that simple. It's often very difficult to explain to a C-level executive what the real technology cost in time and money is for what they want to do. That doesn't absolve developers from understanding the domain model. I always tell developers, if you want to do something that violates the architectural principles or assumptions that we have made together, surface it for immediate discussion. So the architect helps the business owner understand what the technological implications of what they want to do. This doesn't always happen, but in successful projects, it usually does. Similarly, the architect looks at the exit conditions for an iteration and makes sure that they are consistent with the emergent properties and architectural assumptions. Have we interfered with the performance or the scalability or the legal requirements in what we did? Keeping track of these things has to be someone's responsibility. Context is everything. Eliel Saarinen was the famous son of an even more famous architect. Always design a thing by considering it in its next larger context. A chair in a room in a house, an environment in a city plan. This is important for both architects and developers. Whenever you have a question about a conflict between principles or have to make a trade-off, use the context to help you decide between the alternatives. And don't fight the last war. We're not fighting over the waterfall model or cowboy coding anymore. It's not a choice between two alternatives that are symbolized by these two Shanghai buildings, between the Baroque, bizarre, over-designed building on the left, being compared with the building on the right that's barely held up with bamboo poles. Nobody really believes in waterfall anymore, and very few people do real waterfall anymore. And nobody believes in cowboy coding without thinking about design and architecture. It's over. This is a false choice. It's a stale battle. Let's get beyond this. What we have to understand is what the particular problems are in a given environment and what is the best way to solve them in that particular context. In thinking about this problem, I like to remember this quote from T.X. Huxley's review of Darwin's Origin of the Species. History warns us that it is the customary fate of new truths to begin as heresies and to end as superstitions. Almost everything that we take for granted was heretical at some point. And in the process of convincing people, we make it into a dogma. And once we take it as a dogma, we accept it uncritically. We don't think about context, and we don't think about what is important in a given situation. We just react. But in reality, it's all a question of trade-offs. And what I have found in my many years of doing software is that the questions are usually better than the answers. There is no resolution to this tension between agility and discipline, or large projects and small projects, or this design or some other design. You'll be always asking questions. And of course, coming up with solutions does not make the problems go away. As the requirements change, you will have to answer those same questions over and over again. Or even if you have solved the problem for one project, you will now have to ask all those questions all over again on the next project. They don't go away. So what is it that I believe? The architect is not the lead developer, not the super developer, not the design reviewer. It is the team that owns the design and the supervision of craftsmanship. But what the architect does own is the totality of the user experience. And again, this user experience is the emergent properties, not just the user interface. And that is what I think the role of an architect is. And if you want to be an architect, the steps you have to take is to view software development from this perspective. But if you're not an architect, it's not a bad thing. The world needs architects. The world needs developers. And they are different skill sets. But never stop questioning. Never take anything that someone says for granted. Think about it critically. Think about how it pertains to this particular project and what you're working on right now. Thank you very much.